If I can move on a little bit, Hilary Talgwin, you've looked closely at the relationship between language and power as well in international law. You've exposed what you call the hidden gender of international law, including the highly gendered debate about terrorism since September 11. Could you explain what you mean by the hidden gender of international law? I mean, aren't women also suicide bombers in Sri Lanka and elsewhere? And doesn't international law, with its emphasis on women's rights and equality, give far more attention to gender than most national legal systems?
First of all, I want to draw a distinction, and I can see various former students of mine in the audience will start yawning now, but I draw a distinction here between sex and gender, first of all. So I think just the mere inclusion of women or attention to women is different from what I'm interested when I talk about the word gender. You're absolutely correct that I guess over the last decade and a half there has been a lot greater interest in women, certainly rhetorically. And so you find actually on the White House website, in their part of the website devoted to the war in Iraq, they actually have a special part of the website devoted to their concern for Iraqi women and how one of the many reasons they're in there is to help Iraqi women come out of, you know, the dark night of Saddam Hussein's time. First of all, I just say the greater attention to the rhetoric concerning women hasn't been met in action. I think that most governments now sort of express concern with the position of women. We also see this, for example, in Afghanistan, but when you actually look at what's happened on the ground, you don't see that interest in women translate into action, or else interest in women is constantly trumped by the omnibus term culture. So as soon as somebody says, sorry, you might want a few more women in our parliament, but that's incompatible with our culture, what the West typically does is to say, oh, sorry, terribly sorry we mentioned that, we'll just go away and pack our bags and forget about it. So first of all, I don't think the greater language about women has been all good. But just when I got interested, and much of my work in this area has been done with Connor's colleague, Christine Chinkin, and we've worked on this together, but guess what we've been really interested in is the way that a lot of international law and international relations really, and a lot of international rhetoric, is built on a series of dichotomies that we sort of take for granted. So you've got dichotomies in the context of the war against terror of, you know, sort of chaos and security on one hand. So you can choose chaos or security. You've got virtue and evil is another very strong dichotomy that emerges. Active, passive. Is another one. One of my favourite ones actually comes from Tony Blair. I don't mean just to completely get sucked in, but he keeps saying in a number of his speeches, he said this before Kosovo, he said this before going into Afghanistan, he said this before going into Iraq. He said, we must do something or nothing. That's one of his dichotomies. So, and then of course, the something, we do something or nothing. It's just not very profound, but the issue for me is that something is always associated with military action. So something, being active, being sort of responsible, means military action. So I think we've been really interested over the last few years in the way international law too privileges the parts of the dichotomy that are typically associated with masculine modes of behaviour. That's not to say, I hasten to add, they're associated with the behaviour of particular men at all, but it's just associated with masculinity. And it is possible, of course, to be sexed as a woman, but to be gendered as a man. And you can think of people like Margaret Thatcher and some of her very warlike, belligerent language over the Falklands, for example, is an example of that. And Condoleezza Rice is a really intriguing example of, I think, some confusions of sex and gender in that way. But so I guess what we've been trying to do in the context of this so-called war against terror is to try to point out that by international law and the international community constantly privileging one side of dichotomies, you're actually ruling out a lot of action. You're sort of saying the only response to this is military. You're not thinking about broader strategies. We're certainly not arguing for everything to suddenly go for the other side of the dichotomy, which is coded as feminized in some way at all. I think that would be equally problematic. What we're talking about is to try and get a broader range of reactions and solutions to issues on the table.
Connor Gizzi, can I ask you about the evil which Hilary just mentioned? You've described as quote, the greatest single disastrous legacy of the war on terror from a human rights point of view, as the supersession of the criminal model based on justice and due process by a security model that's based on fear and suspicion. My question to you is the ordinary criminal law really sufficient to combat the threat of modern terrorism? And isn't Michael Ignatieff, who you mentioned earlier, justified in calling for the West to fight evil with a democratic lesser evil of its own? And don't we sometimes need to fight diversion?
I think I'll approach this by making a couple of points about the weaknesses in our position. By our, I mean the civil libertarian, human rights kind of person. And then I'll address directly. Weakness number one is a temptation to use hyperbolic language. And I have done that. For example, I remember very clearly in the mid-1980s, we thought, and I'm paraphrasing but not by far, that Britain was becoming a police state. We thought the piece of law, the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, that we now think of as a model of good police practice, was introducing into the country a police state. And you never open your papers, but you find us, liberals, announcing the end of the world as we know it. And I put it in the form of two questions to my British friends, and they really find it quite difficult. How come we're always becoming a police state but never become one? And two, how come the Home Secretary is always the worst Home Secretary ever until the next one? So there is a really serious issue here about our inflating the language. And there is that problem. I'll come back to why it relates to this in a moment. The second is, related to that, is we sometimes, again, we the Liberals, give the impression that we have no interest in tackling terrorism, to take the example. That we actually are a sort of anarchic, that we're anti-law, that we'd rather prefer to have no attacks on those poor mites who attacked the World Trade Center or who blew up the Diskin Valley. And that was evident, I have to say, shortly after the World Trade Center, or the attacks on the World Trade Center on the 11th September 2001, we human rights people, you know, I hate to even use that even community, we were very unsure what to say. But then when Mr. Bush introduced the Patriot Act, we all know then what to say, what scandal it is, telephone tapping, and we're in our usual little happy place of criticising governmental action. So we need to wise up on both of those sores, which takes me to the question. Because the line I take on this kind of thing is when I'm attacked for being this kind of anarchist, I say, well, I'm not the anarchist. The anarchists are the people who want to replace our codes of criminal law, international and national, both, with wild assertions of terrorism which underpin administrative discretion which is uncontrollable. What we need is to recognise that the kinds of things that people we call terrorists do are already serious criminal offences. We need to ensure that the authorities have the right levels of investigative powers and the right technological support to achieve the outcome we desire, which is to arrest and punish these people, but to do so efficiently, which includes having regard to their rights in order to assure a fair trial. And that the criminal model is actually a useful one with which to tackle terrorism. On the international level, Hillary will know more than me, but if there are cross-border problems, as there are in many areas, you have cross-border agreements, and if this requires a convention on something like hijacking of an airplane or on attacking heads of state, go ahead and get the convention. Now, it's also the case, we have to concede, that we're not wedded to a particular content of criminal law, nor are we wedded to a particular procedure. It would be silly for me to say that in 1861, they got it right in England, and we're not going to change the crimes, and we're not going to change the procedures. Where there are problems which are properly identified, which impede convictions, such as, for example, intimidation of witnesses, you'll find that these are problems across the criminal law nowadays and not specific to terrorism, then we need to be flexible about things like witness immunities, about witness protection, about secret witnesses and so on. I am not wedded to some outdated model. I want convictions as much as the next guy, but I want them through the criminal process. And what's the difference? This is the difference. This is the difference. It's a difference in an attitude of mind. The Stella Rimington used to run MI5, the Secret Services in Britain. Now, of course, that she's retired, she's become a civil libertarian. Have you noticed how everybody who was part of this, whenever they retire, they become civil libertarians? She gave a lecture on the BBC, and she said, we've had great success in the war against, they used to call it the battle against terrorism, I think, in those days. She said, we have 500 Irish terrorists awaiting trial. I was upstairs in the room listening to this on the radio. No, 500 suspected terrorists awaiting trial, Ms. Remington, surely. What was significant about that was this was a big public address which must have gone through numerous drafts. It occurred to none of them that you could be possibly a suspected terrorist. You'd never say, this is the final remark, you'd never say 500 murderers awaiting trial, because you know that the word murder carries within it a judgment of a process. And that's the upside of concentrating on the criminal process. It keeps us rooted in respect for rights and outcomes that actually are the most effective counterterrorism outcomes in the long run.
Hilary Charlesworth, one of the problems here, including in the criminal process which Connor has just outlined, is the government always say, trust us, we're democratic, we've got access to all the security information. At the end of last year, when the anti-terrorism bill was being debated here in Australia, you gave advice under the ACT, Human Rights Act, to the ACT Chief Minister about the human rights impact of the anti-terrorism bill in its various forms. Being outside government as an academic, did you find it difficult to make judgments about the necessity and the proportionality of proposed restrictions on rights to combat terrorism?
I didn't at all, because in a sense they weren't relevant to what we were doing. I mean, one of the problems is those of you who follow closely the anti-terror debates, the legislative debates late last year, was that there was this COAG meeting where the Prime Minister gets the state leaders and territory leaders into a room. He wheels in Mick Kelty, the head of our police force, to sort of give them a briefing. Oh, to have been at that briefing, because it managed to convince everybody that we absolutely had to change the laws. And then I was very struck by the fact that was seen as absolutely acceptable to have secret advice that's never been divulged, and there's like a secret brotherhood of people who've received the Kelty briefing and the rest of us haven't. And so on the basis of that, everybody, even our fairly stroppy Chief Minister in the ACT, seemed convinced we absolutely had to change the laws. But it struck me, why couldn't we have had some information? We, the poor public, and as you and others have pointed out, a very striking thing is that ASIO has never upgraded its security rating to where we are since 2001. So if there were something truly new and terrible which meant that we had to sort of change our laws, surely that should be reflected in some way. So I think it's very easy to be... I think we should be able to question what was that information. Also, of course, we know that the government in the past... little while we've been exposed to a lot of errors that the federal government has acted on, quite a number of wrong pieces of security assessments. That's now all in the public realm. But the more sort of critical point I want to make is that I think our advice on that laws, and that of course was done with your new colleague, Andrew Burns and Gabriel McKinnon, my colleague at the ANU, the advice that we prepared, I think our advice would have stood whatever the level of terrorist threat was, because there has absolutely been no evidence that the very draconian measures that were introduced by that legislation, particularly control orders and the preventive detention regime, would have had any impact on reducing a terrorist threat. That link between there's a heightened terrorist threat, therefore we must use these particular mechanisms, there's been no evidence at all that they're useful. And indeed, the evidence that's coming out, there have been a couple of very interesting reports in the UK showing that these type of very draconian laws, if anything, actually increase terrorist threats. So if you're actually serious about wanting to reduce terrorist threats, you would not be using laws like that. And I completely endorse what Connor said about the framework of criminal law as being a more appropriate one than this specialised, draconian, narrow set of laws. It seems to me that in that sense, a human rights framework for those anti-terror laws would have not only been the most principled approach, but I'm also making the point that it would have been the most strategic approach.
Can I add to that? Because I think we've got to the core, one of the core issues here is private briefings.
It really is a core issue. And, of course, it's very difficult to gainsay private briefings. Very difficult. But you can observe from history. Geoffrey Bennett's written a very good article about 1867, the Fenian attacks, completely deceitful response by the state, arguing about all the terrorism that didn't exist and so on. 1939, it's also been proved, because we have access to the papers now, that the remarks being made by the Home Secretary to support the introduction of a terrorism law at the time, grossly misleading, insinuating that there was factious support for the IRA when there clearly wasn't, pretending the IRA was about to blow up the House of Parliament when the documents they'd had on that were speculative and they'd had them for months anyway. 1996, the last one I'll mention because I have first-hand remembrance of this, first-hand. The British government, then John Major, introduced a terrorism law in Easter week. It had never been heard of on the Friday before Easter week. It was law by the Wednesday of Easter week. The IRA were about to mount a massive campaign of violence in to commemorate the 80th anniversary of the Easter Rising. There were private briefings given to the opposition. Nobody could say what was going on, but they were all terrified. It turned out, firstly, they'd got the date wrong. It wasn't even the celebration of Easter. It was 80. They forgot it was a movable feast. But secondly, and this is the core point, I actually had occasion to talk to a senior Labour Party person who was a senior shadow cabinet minister at the time, and who was brought in on what the British called Privy Council briefings. And I said, were there specific threats? How clear was it? She said, very general. Now, she's not supposed to say anything, and they're not supposed to tell anybody anything, but it was very general. These briefings are secret for a reason, because they are given, as far as I can tell, quite often very general stuff, and then they're extrapolated from that. However, the weapons for mass destruction debacle over Iraq may have permanently damaged the capacity of these informal and formal briefings to intimidate. And you saw the first effect of that in the Belmarsh case. Reading between the lines, and Lord Scott is clear about it, these people, the judges, didn't really believe the intelligence because they knew that the intelligence over Iraq had been grossly misleading, which is a shocking thing in a democracy if the intelligence is well-meaning and might be right, that the politicians were so able to manipulate it that they've caused the intelligence services to be so held in such low regard. Anyway, sorry to interrupt, but that is a core point, that one, I think.
Well, Colin, if I could stay with you and follow on from Hillary's last response. Restrictions on rights in countering terrorism seem to be reaching ever invasively into more and more areas of daily life, from whether certain kinds of speech can be uttered without committing crimes of sedition or glorifying terrorism in the UK, whether a Muslim can wear a headscarf to school or university, or even new citizenship tests which will examine for knowledge of mainstream British or Australian or Dutch values in the famous video case. Are measures such as these rationally connected to countering terrorism? Or are they political gimmicks which appeal to patriotic sentiment or even a crude aversion to difference in the political sphere?
Well, I think once you buy into the language of good and evil, the language of clash of civilizations, which this good and evil thing is dependent on, and you see these communities within your culture as essentially coming from a foreign place with foreign attitudes and producing so-called terrorists to destroy your society, you have really put yourself in the position intellectually of saying, why don't they get out, you know? Or if they're going to be here, why don't they be perfect little Brits or perfect little Australians? Because it seems to me you have created, one has created in one's own mind a sense of the otherness of these people. And a lot flows from that. And I think that's why we have to fight this idea of a clash of civilizations. It takes an awful lot to alienate a most conservative-minded, in the best sense, community, like the Islamic community in Britain. I have a friend who works in government, and he was very funny on this. He said, you Irish, he says, my goodness, you are anarchic. You know, you would have a fight anyway. He was laughing, you know, but he said, the Islamic people are very, very conservative. They're very law-abiding. And to go about provoking by legislation that really can seem to be aimed directly at them is foolish. Now, in fairness to the British government, some of the legislation it has sought has been to assuage those communities. There was a very good report done by the House of Commons Home Affairs Committee on terrorism and community relations. Britain has to some extent picked up some of the disastrous mistakes it made with the Irish. And it would be unfair here for me to allow a caricature of Britain to be presented, which is one where it's alienating Islamic politicians, communities right, left and centre. The British also, controversially, I think you're partly alluding to this, enacted an incitement to religious hatred law. And I was one of the people, I supported that law, I didn't oppose it. One of the main problems the Islamic community has is double standards. If you attack the Christian faith, it's blasphemy. If you attack us, it's free speech. So they were seeking to kind of try and level the playing field across the communities, and that's laudable. On the headscarf, Britain has, on Islamic dress generally, Britain has, I believe, a very appropriate and benign approach to kind of the expression of religious faith in dress in schools and elsewhere, which is basically health and safety issues, etc. aside, you can wear more or less what you wish. And most schools that are not faith-based schools have that approach and that are not uniform-based schools. So Britain's done well on that one in comparison with other countries which have taken a very strong hostile line which has been interpreted by communities from the Islamic faith as attacks on them.
Okay, in view of time, we do need to move on, and I've got I'll put a couple more questions to you, I suppose, and then we'll go for drinks. Hilary Charlesworth, our Attorney General and the Prime Minister of Britain have both supported this very fuzzy idea of human security, as have you and Connor in your previous writings. How does your understanding of human security differ from that of the Attorney General, who says that victims of terrorism have a right to life and security of person which trumps the rights of terrorists?
Yeah, well, my first reaction was I was thrilled that Philip Ruddock, our Attorney General, had shown such an interest in international law because he's generally quite hostile to it. And I actually was sort of struck by the fact that one of his speeches, and of course Robert Cornell, the head of his department, also made a speech where they extolled the virtues, they're referring particularly, I think, to Article 3 of the Universal Declaration as the basis of this right to human security. So in a sense, it was quite interesting. So I think it was an attempt to meet the human rights critics of the anti-terror laws on their own terms and just say, you guys aren't the only ones interested in human rights. We're interested in human rights too. They're just slightly different ones to you. And here is the Trump right. And it was quite interesting because, of course, our Attorney General relied a lot on the Canadian Attorney General Erwin Kotler's writing. So it's been a fascinating sort of import of ideas. But from an international lawyer's perspective, I think our Attorney General has just taken one tiny sliver of human rights law and developed it quite out of context. So I find the idea of human security that Mr. Ruddock and the head of his department have been using a lot really problematic. First of all, I mean, the text of Article 3, which is of the Universal Declaration, and as a technical point, it's fascinating that the attorney doesn't actually referring to the Universal Declaration, which international lawyers will recognise as a declaration, rather than the comparable treaty obligation, Article 6 of the Civil and Political Covenant, but that's a very technical point. So the wording is, everyone's entitled to life, liberty and security of the person. But in Mr. Ruddock's translation, he drops the right to liberty. So that's just sort of left out. It's sort of very curious translation. So it's only part of it. And he also ignores a lot of international jurisprudence on the meaning of the right. And really what he's done is to convert something that's understood as an individual right to be free from too much governmental intrusion. He sort of moved to make it really a right to homeland security. So he's taken an individual right and really created this communal right. So he's taken a right that's meant to be used, if you like, in the classic sense, against the state, to really be the state's right. It's sort of quite an interesting and complicated move. So I actually have a lot of problems with the way that he's done that. And I find the curiousness of his analysis, where he just picks and chooses absolutely at random. I don't think domestic lawyers would let him get away with that if he just picked and chose words from the Constitution, for example, to make an argument. But he's managed to do that in the context of international law, and I think very few in our community have actually stood up and said, look, this is wrong.
And of course our attorney proudly wears his Amnesty International badge on his lapel, including when he's batting away the Human Rights Committee in Geneva.
Yes, it's good optics.
Connor Geertie, if I could move on to the final couple of questions on the causes of and solutions to terrorism. You've criticised Western governments for failing to address the root causes of terrorism, particularly, as you say, the paralysing Israeli-Palestinian dispute. First of all, do you see Palestinian terrorism as ever a justifiable response to Israeli policies? And secondly, what do you see as the responsibility of the West in both perpetuating and resolving that conflict?
Well, I think our subject, terrorism, originates in the Middle East. There were in the 1960s and the early 1970s a series of disparate but isolated examples of politically subversive violence in Britain, elsewhere, Ireland, Spain, Germany, and also the Middle East, as a result of the Seven-Day War and the successful defeat of the Arab states, followed by the occupation of land unlawfully. And these disparate types of political violence included Palestinian violence. And when the Palestinian violence was getting quite a lot of, shall we say, support, a brilliant achievement was then brought about, which was to equate all of this subversive violence under a general title of terrorism, and to include Palestinian violence as terrorism, in the way that the Red Brigades were, in the way that the Beit al-Ma'arif were, and the various other types of political violence. So this subject is born, in my view, in the Middle East. The effect of this was to deprive the Palestinian situation of any kind of context, because it was the offshoot of a terrorist problem, not a problem of international relations. That has remained the mainstay of our understanding of the Middle East. And you see it most recently in the refusal to engage in the democratically elected government in Palestine on the basis that it is a terrorist organisation, even though it has, prior to the election, given indications that it would not engage in political violence. And it is required to surrender. Let's call it space. It is required to agree that it is not permitted to engage in any kind of solution before it is accorded recognition. The most extraordinary situation. I've slightly overstated, but not by much. Do I find Palestinian violence justifiable? The answer is very clear. The answer is no. No. It's not justifiable. I looked into this when I was thinking about it at the end of one of my first book on this, and I think it's not. People may think it's understandable, it's not justifiable. There is a tremendous opportunity now, in my view, for Palestine, with an elected government which has the trust of the people, if it can somehow or other grow quickly to an understanding of what politics involves, and if I may say so, look carefully at the kinds of things that Gerry Adams has been able to do in Northern Ireland. Not a person whom I've ever supported, but he's been able to do extraordinary work in bringing his own organisation into politics. If they can do that, then there is the possibility of engaging in the resolution of this horrific example of injustice, because the solution isn't as complicated as people say, it's just that one side won't agree to it. So that if that could be done, there will be the possibility of action. I don't think killing works in the Middle East, because it plays into the hands of those who want to keep instability.
Hilary Charlesworth, there's no prospect of intervention in Palestine by the international community. But military responses to terrorism have obviously been a big part of the post-September 11 response. You've called for humanitarian intervention in the past, in East Timor, for example, in 1999, even if the Security Council didn't approve of any international intervention. Would you support intervention in Darfur, in Sudan, today? And if so, under what conditions? And what would be your legal justification? And furthermore, what does international law say about the aftermath of intervention? You know, should the West impose democracy and human rights and elections and so forth?
I'm only going to answer some of those because I know everybody wants a drink. There are a lot of questions rolled up there. First of all, I want to say that the notion of humanitarian intervention, that term, has been given a very bad name by what happened in Iraq, because one of the many justifications that was used in different ways, particularly by Tony Blair, but also by our own Prime Minister in Iraq, was this one of, we're going to save the Iraqis, and I think the problems of that whole intervention have given the notion of humanitarian intervention, have shown all of its problems. The fact that it's very, can be self-judging in that context, the fact that it can be based on utterly unreliable material, and the fact that you can cause tremendous havoc that arguably would, I mean, people are making the point that if Saddam Hussein were to turn up in a different guise, with a different name today, he'd be welcomed with open arms as a fantastic leader of Iraq. He's a nice, strong man who'll bring security. So there's sort of a deep irony in what sort of happened there. So I wanted to make that point. What's happened since then, I think since 99, has been these quite interesting developments in the international scene, and a lot of them spearheaded by our own Gareth Evans, who's really been behind developing this notion. Well, when people say state sovereignty means there should never be any intervention, he and various commissions that he's been part of have developed this idea of the so-called responsibility to protect. The idea is that a state is sovereign only insofar as it fulfills its duty to protect the people within its jurisdiction. So Gareth Evans, on a Canadian-sponsored commission, sort of introduced this notion in late 2001 in the context of Kosovo, should there have been intervention in Kosovo, and styling it as a responsibility to protect. And he, because he sort of stars on every international high-level panel that's ever been created, I've decided, he has managed to get that idea further and further into the UN system, and it's been given its ultimate, if you like, imprimatur in the Kofi Annan's report last year, In Larger Freedom, where he sort of adopted this idea of responsibility to protect. And then that, in turn, was actually included in a General Assembly resolution at the end of the World Summit last year, where the General Assembly says, yes, we recognise that states have a responsibility to protect, and crucially, if they're not observing that responsibility to protect, there is a duty on the United Nations, the international community, through the United Nations, to intervene. So that was only adopted in late last year. It seems to me that if one's looking for a legal justification for intervention in Darfur, you have it exceptionally clearly. Darfur has to be a classic case of the responsibility to protect one's citizens going haywire, not being at all observed. So I think that there is, it's not very difficult to find a legal basis in that sense. So I would certainly support it. The more really complicated and fascinating questions you asked about what do we do after that, do we suddenly say, okay, we've got a model of democracy in our back pocket and here it is, guys, I'm going to leave for another conversation.
And on to our final question then for Panagiotis. You've criticised militant humanitarianism, which developed in the 1990s and which partly justified the invasion of both Iraq and Afghanistan. Few people doubt that humanitarian intervention has been selectively applied and politically abused. But would you do nothing in Darfur or Rwanda if the Security Council was silent? And do you think that Hilary Charlesworth is an objectionable human rights militant, in your words?
I mean, without reserving the position of whether she's objectionable, she's not an objectionable human rights militant. And in not objectionable at all, I have to say. Not objectionable at all. I think you're trying to introduce some violence towards the very end of the evening. The reason I think that, for example, Palestinian violence is not justifiable, I'm not a pacifist, you know, and I'm not coming at that from a pacifist position. For exactly the same reason, I'm not, you know, a priori opposed to intervention. And I think a lot of us were really waving the flag around the Kosovo time. And I remember being extremely proud of my Prime Minister, referred to as my Prime Minister earlier, Tony Blair, when he gave a speech in Chicago, developing a kind of doctrine of international community and going through various hoops that you should jump through in order to justify intervention. There were five or six. After, when he announced he was going to go into Iraq, when you subjected those five or six to scrutiny, none of them stood up. And that's a problem. And I'll just come back to that. With the 11th September 2001, episode, it became politically possible to take action against the Taliban administration in Afghanistan. I felt, since I'd, insofar as I'd argued about this, not as an expert but as a concerned layperson, since I'd argued for intervention in Afghanistan on broadly feminist grounds and interesting environmental grounds, I thought, before 11 September, I thought it would have been kind of eccentric of me to have said, well, now that they've attacked New York, I'm against intervention. So I was, broadly speaking, in favour of that, without having any authority or seriousness of weight in the field. However, it's gone wrong. And it's a little bit gone wrong the way what Hillary's talking about, human security, and what happened a bit with human rights. You throw powerful words up into the air, and they work. You have to be prepared for people with bad faith to grab them and use them to achieve ends that they're not explicit about. And I think what causes us all to be concerned is that we threw into the air a really terrific idea, which is intervention in order to protect people, but we found that the biggest guy in the playground is able to grab it and use it for their own ends in a way which leaves us behind saying, we didn't mean that at all. And that really causes me a great deal of anxiety. However, I mean, I just don't know where I end up on that. I mean, I don't know whether it means I say never again because I've been burnt and... but that seems to me absolutely impossible when you think about examples like Rwanda. I mean, I don't know enough about what's going on in Darfur, but I mean, there could be similar things going on at the moment, and it seems outrageous that one would say that. But without the structures that actually enable good faith to operate here, and without the vulnerability to bad faith that the system permits at the moment, then it's really quite a nervy thing to hand these blank checks for violence to organise military power that is engaged in that violence for other reasons. So I end up uncertain and nervous about this one.
Okay, on that note, there are many more questions for both speakers, but that'll have to wait to, until Connor's next visit to Australia and when we host a sequel to this conversation. Before we end, I just have a few thank yous. First of all, to all of you for coming along. Secondly, to the Honourable Greg Pearce, a member of the Upper House in the New South Wales Parliament, who has made this venue available for us this evening. The Gilbert and Tobin Centre for Public Law's Terrorism and Law Project, which is hosting this event tonight and supporting Connor's visit to Australia and Hillary's shorter trip up from Canberra. UNSW Law School, our sponsors, the Red Cross, the International Law Association, Australian section, and all of our volunteers from UNSW Law School who helped out this evening. Paul Kildare, Katie Nesbitt, Tessa Mayrick, Anna Sawick, Dominic Dallapozza, and the director of the Terrorism and Law Project, Andrew Lynch. I do have to plug one little event before you go. On the 16th of May, the Australian Centre for Human Rights is hosting a major public lecture by Professor Connor Geertie on human security and human rights. There's information on the tables out the front about that event if you're interested in going along to that, and he'll give a more polished performance than his event tonight.
I feel.
And before we adjourn to the foyer, where I invite all of you to join us for a drink and to put questions to both Connor and Hillary, who can stay around for a little while, I'd like to ask you to join with me in thanking both speakers for a terrific